Port-au-Prince does not sleep in silence. It sleeps in a state of suspended breath. In the neighborhoods of Bel Air and Cite Soleil, the sound of a motorbike is not just transport, it is a signal. Since the mid-1980s, the line between a community leader and a warlord in Haiti has blurred until it disappeared. We often look at these armed groups as a sudden plague. We see the masked faces and the heavy weapons on our screens and think this is new. It is not. This is a story of a vacuum that was never filled. It is a story of how our neighbors became our captors because the state found it easier to arm the poor than to feed them. Now, in 2026, the bill has come due. The fear is no longer shadow. It is the only thing left standing. Chapter 1. The Ghosts of the McCout. The year is 1986. The private jet carrying Jean-Claude Duvalier disappears into the sky, headed for exile in France. On the ground, the air in Port-au-Prince is thick with the smell of burning tires, and the sound of a million people finally exhaling. The dictatorship that strangled Haiti for 29 years is over, but the nightmare is just changing clothes. Under the Duvalier, the country was policed by the Milice de Volontaires de la Sécurité Nationale. We knew them better as the Tonton Macout. They were the bogeymen. They wore denim and dark glasses. They carried machetes and old rifles. They were not an army. They were a neighborhood surveillance system designed to kill hope at the source. When the regime collapsed, the Macout did not vanish. They just stopped wearing the uniform. The people called for déchoucage. It means uprooting. In the streets, the crowds hunted down the former enforcers. They tore down their houses. They took back what they could. It was a moment of raw, unrefined justice. But you cannot uproot a system that has spent 3 decades planting its seeds in every street corner. The Macout went underground. They kept their guns. They kept their local knowledge. They waited for the new power to realize that in Haiti you cannot rule without a fist. By the late 1980s, the military had taken control. The coups became a seasonal event. In the slums, the people realized the army was not there to protect them. The army was there to contain them. Small groups of young men began to organize. At first, they were defense committees. They were meant to protect the neighborhood from the remnants of the Macout and the brutality of the soldiers. They called themselves vigilance brigades. This is the birth of the tragedy. It starts with a need for safety. When the police do not come, when the state sees you as an enemy, you look to the man next door with a pistol. You give him a little money. You give him authority. You trade a piece of your freedom for the promise that he will keep the bigger monsters away. But guns have a way of changing the person holding them. The vigilance brigades began to demand more than just respect. They began to tax the markets. They began to decide who could walk down which street. The military saw this and did not stop it. They realized that a neighborhood fighting itself is a neighborhood that cannot overthrow a government. The ghosts of the Macout watched from the shadows. They saw that the new boys were using the same methods they had perfected. By 1991, the first democratic hope of the nation, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was tossed out by a bloody military coup. The soldiers and their paramilitary allies, known as FRAF, turned the streets into a slaughterhouse. They targeted the neighborhood organizers. They killed the leaders who actually cared about the community. What was left behind were the opportunists, the men who were willing to work with anyone, as long as the bullets kept coming. The fear began to settle into the concrete. It was no longer about politics. It was about who controlled the water pump. It was about who owned the intersection. The international community looked on and saw chaos. They did not see the deliberate dismantling of civic life. They did not see how the neighborhood group was being forged into a weapon of political survival. As the 1990s drew to a close, the stage was set. The old enforcers were gone or integrated. The new enforcers were hungry, and the politicians returning from exile had learned a lesson. They would never again rely on an army that could turn on them. They would build their own armies in the alleys where the police feared to go. The sun sets over Port-au-Prince in 1999, and the shadows are longer than they used to be. The neighborhood is no longer a sanctuary. It is a garrison. And the men standing at the gate are waiting for a phone call from the National Palace. The leash was being prepared, but nobody knew who would be holding it. Chapter 2. The Chimiere and the Leash. By the year 2000, the language of power in Haiti had changed. The neighborhood groups were no longer just defense committees. They had become the chimeres. In Greek mythology, the chimera is a fire-breathing monster made of different parts. In Port-au-Prince, the chimeras were the young men of the slums, the base, who became the unofficial security detail for the presidency. The government of the early 2000s realized that the masses were its only shield against the elite and the military. But the masses are hard to direct. You need middlemen. You need the grand dons. These were the local bosses who could turn out 1,000 protesters or 100 gunmen with a single word. The relationship was simple and deadly. The politicians provided the money and the guns. In return, the neighborhood groups ensured that the opposition could not hold a rally. They made sure the votes went the right way. They provided the muscle for the manifestations. For a young man in Sitsule, joining the local base was the only job that paid. It was the only way to have a name. We must be clear about the cost. This was not a partnership of equals. It was a parasitic bond. The state used the poverty of the slums as a recruitment tool. They kept the neighborhoods desperate, so that a $50 bill and a bag of rice would be enough to buy a man's life. The fear shifted. It wasn't just fear of the government anymore. It was fear of your own neighbor, who now had a brand new Galileo rifle and the blessing of the palace. This era saw the total professionalization of neighborhood violence. The groups began to take on names. They carved out territories with invisible borders. If you lived on one side of the road, you did not cross to the other. Began to run local economies. They controlled the distribution of aid. They controlled the charcoal trade. They became a shadow state, more efficient and more tariff the self-king, the chief call, the pain. In 2004, the system broke. Another rebellion, another coup. When the central power collapsed, the leash was cut. The Chimeres were left with their guns but without their paychecks. The international peacekeepers arrived, but they did not understand the streets. They saw gangs. They did not see the complex web of social survival and political betrayal. The violence of the mid-2000s was a war for the remnants of the leash. The neighborhood groups fought each other for control of the ports and the kidnapping trade. Kidnapping became the new currency. It was no longer about political ideology. It was about the ransom. No one was safe. Not the doctor, not the school teacher, not the street vendor. The state tried to buy them off again. They created commissions for disarmament and reintegration. They offered money for guns. But why would a man give up a rifle that gives him the power of a king for a few $100s and a job training program that leads nowhere? The guns stayed. The resentment grew. By the time the earthquake hit in 2010, the neighborhood groups were the only ones left with an organized structure. In the ruins, they were the ones who moved the supplies. They were the ones who protected the camps for the displaced. The disaster did not weaken the groups. It gave them a new landscape to dominate. The politicians of the 2010s saw this and decided they could play the game better. They stopped pretending to want peace. They began to use the neighborhood groups as private contractors for land grabs and to suppress dissent against corruption. The groups were becoming more sophisticated. They started using social media. They started giving interviews. They were no longer hidden. They were the face of the street. The fear was now a permanent resident. It was in the way people walked. It was in the way they talked on the phone, always lower than they needed to. The neighborhood group was no longer a defender. It was a landlord that charged for the air you breathed. And then, the money started to dry up. The Petrocaribe funds were gone. The state was broke. The groups looked at the politicians and realized they didn't need the middleman anymore. They had the guns. They had the territory. The leash didn't just break. It was turned around. The Dobbs were now leading the master. Chapter 3. The Federation of Terror. By 2018, the neighborhood groups had reached their final form. They were no longer disparate gangs. They were becoming a corporate entity. The most famous face of this evolution is Jimmy Cherizier, a former police officer known as Barbecue. He did something the others had failed to do. He organized. He brought together 9 of the most powerful groups in the capital to form the G9 family and allies. This was not a street gang. It was a federation. They released videos with high production value. They spoke about revolution. They spoke about the bourgeoisie and the corrupt system. But the reality remained written in blood. The G9 and their rivals, the GPEP, turned Port-au-Prince into a chessboard of fire. In neighborhoods like La Saline and Cité Soleil, they didn't just kill, they erased. They burned houses by the hundreds. They used sexual violence as a tool of territorial control. The fear reached a level that the country had not seen since the days of the Makut. When President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in July 2021, the last thin veil of the state fell away. The neighborhood groups were the only real power left. They controlled the fuel terminals. They could shut down the entire country by simply closing a valve. They were no longer asking for a seat at the table. They were the table. The impact on the community is a slow death. Schools in the red zones have been closed for years. Hospitals are raided for supplies. The economy is a series of tolls. Every truck of food coming from the countryside must pay a tax to every group it passes. By the time the food reaches the market, the price is tripled. The people are starving, not because there is no food, but because the neighborhood groups have turned eating into a luxury. In response, the people finally broke. In 2023, the Bloc Collie movement began. It was a spontaneous, violent eruption of neighborhood defense. Civilians, tired of being hunted, began to hunt the gang members. They used machetes and stones. They practiced their own form of street justice. It was a sign of total state failure. When the people have to become the monsters they feared just to survive the night, the social contract is not just broken. It is incinerated. Today, in 2026, the situation remains a stalemate of misery. International missions have arrived, but the neighborhood groups have had 40 years to dig into the concrete. They are not just on the streets. They are in the family structures. They are the only government a 10-year-old boy in Bel Air has ever known. We have to look at this history and ask what it means for our future. We see a cycle where every attempt to provide security through informal violence has led to a deeper cage. The neighborhood groups were born from a need for protection, fed by political greed, and matured into a system of total extraction. The fear is now a baseline. It is the static on the radio. People have learned to navigate the borders. They know which colors to wear. They know which names to praise. But this is not living. It is a siege. Katy is a nation of neighborhoods. But right now, the neighborhoods are at war with the nation. The gangs are not an outside force. They are the sons and brothers of the people they oppress. That is the deepest wound. The history of these groups is the history of what happens when a country is treated as a prize to be looted, rather than a home to be built. The guns are still loud. The streets are still divided. The question is no longer who will lead Haiti, but if there will be anything left to lead once the guns finally go silent.